Mr. Secretary, the Alaska Department of Health and Welfare is fortunate to occupy the position of a strong team leader in the field of environmental health protection. Whether we're dealing with problems of the Arctic slope or of southeastern Alaska or of the Alaskan of the Aleutian chain, the department is able to call upon scientists of the state's own departments of natural resources and fish and game, as well as engineering and scientific experts of the Federal Water Pollution Control Administration, the U.S. Geological Survey, and the U.S. Public Health Service, among many others. The state's legal right to abate and to prevent pollution is set forth in the Federal Water Pollution Control Act of 1956. This legislation clearly states congressional intent to charge the state government with primary responsibility for prevention and control of water pollution. Section 10B of this federal act provides, quote, consistent with the policy declaration of this act, state and interstate action to abate pollution of interstate or navigable waters shall be encouraged and shall not be displaced by federal enforcement action, end of quotation. Titles 18 and 46 of the Alaska statutes have assigned to the Department of Health and Welfare the responsibility for controlling environmental pollution throughout the state. This activity encompasses the full range of an educational and enforcement program necessary to prevent and control pollution. The department exercises jurisdiction over all new industrial and municipal sources of pollution and is developing plans to bring under control those discharges which presently exceed our water quality standards. Under the provisions of the Alaska Administrative Code, the department is able to exercise adequate regulatory control of environmental health problems to protect the health and well-being of Alaskans. Specific provisions of the code state that no person shall install or contract for the construction of any public water supply or sewage disposal facility until plans and specifications shall have been approved by the Department of Health and Welfare. According to the code, all designs must have been prepared by a professional engineer registered under the laws of Alaska, assuring that the engineer possesses intimate knowledge of environmental factors peculiar to the Arctic. The designing engineer is also advised to submit preliminary plans and to discuss these with the staff prior to final plan preparation. This procedure has functioned effectively for many years in Alaska, and we're confident that it will continue to do so in the development of the Arctic North Slope. Several months ago, an internationally known consulting engineer was retained by one of the principal firms operating on the slope. The project engineer for this firm discussed his design proposals with department personnel, developed preliminary designs, modified these in response to requests from our plan review engineer, and ultimately gained approval for his client's camp, which is now under construction. These plans included not only water supply and waste disposal for the camp, but also features of housing, ventilation, food service, and the Alaska Plumbing Code, all of which are administered by the Department of Health and Welfare. In the review of planning for major industrial projects, such as the new pulp mill for southeastern Alaska, or the new refineries to be built on the Kenai Peninsula and in the Fairbanks area, the Federal Water Pollution Control Administration has generously made available experts of its Portland regional office to assist the state in assuring that ultimate designs protect the health and welfare of Alaska citizens and comply with adopted water quality standards. In mid-September, a representative of FWPCA, Federal Water Pollution Control Administration, will participate in another such meeting with officials of the oil producer planning a refinery here in the Fairbanks area. In mid-1968, the governor of Alaska, seeing the need for a coordinated approach to oil pollution surveillance, appointed an oil pollution task force, and recognizing the Department of Health and Welfare as the agency statutorily charged with water pollution control, appointed the Commissioner of Health and Welfare as chairman. In addition, representatives of the State Departments of Natural Resources and Fish and Game, the Bureau of Commercial Fisheries, the Bureau of Land Management, the Bureau of Sport Fisheries and Wildlife, the Alaska Water Laboratory, the U.S. Army Engineer District, the U.S. Coast Guard, and of industry participated in the development of plans, including an oil pollution contingency plan to prevent and combat oil spills. Initially, with the help of our federal associates, we have conducted an educational program to bring about a better understanding among industry officials and all employees on drill rigs, pipelines, and elsewhere of the absolute necessity for preventing the loss of oil from any system. The Attorney General filed suit, however, last fall against one industry and a city government, and as necessary, is prepared to initiate additional legal action to assure compliance with Alaska statutes. As part of this control effort, the legislature in 1968 greatly strengthened our water pollution control law by imposing substantially heavier fines for pollution due to negligence. For well over a year, the Federal Water Pollution Control Administration has stationed a biologist and more recently a sanitary engineer in Anchorage to assist the state by monitoring oil pollution in Cook Inlet, by conducting surveillance and reporting oil pollution incidents to the Office of the Commissioner. Earlier this month, a sanitary engineer of the department's staff, together with sanitary engineers of FWPCA and the U.S. Public Health Service, visited some 70 sites where oil prospecting is in progress or where personnel are engaged in related activity on the Arctic North Slope. A report of their inspection of these facilities is now in preparation, and this catalog of living conditions and environmental health situations at each site there will form the basis for state enforcement actions to require camp operators to meet conditions set forth in the administrative code. The Commissioner of Health and Welfare has assigned a long-time Arctic Environmental Engineering staff member, Mr. Amos J. Alter, to direct a comprehensive attack on environmental problems in this part of Alaska. Mr. Alter has lived and worked in Alaska for 25 years and is recognized not only in the United States, but also abroad, as a seasoned veteran, experienced in public health, cause and effect relationships in the Arctic and subarctic. In this review of recent environmental health program activities in Alaska, I should like to stress that big industry has been fully cooperative with state requirements once it understands them and once it is assured that the state will enforce standards equitably. The recent retention by U.S. Plywood Champion Paper of a blue ribbon panel of environmental scientists to evaluate the impact of Champion's new integrated pulp and plywood mill on Southeast Alaska is one indication of industry's desire to be a full partner in protecting our unspoiled Alaskan environment. One important element in this team approach is the close relationship among the state departments, all of whom have an active interest and statutory responsibility for some phase of the development of Alaska's water and related land resources. In this connection, I should comment on the construction camp regulatory activity of the Alaska Department of Labor. Inasmuch as the Alaska Administrative Code requires close cooperation between the Departments of Labor and Health and Welfare in the occupational health field, personnel of our two departments have worked intimately to bring about better housing for the worker on the North Slope and to provide a safer, healthier work atmosphere. One further feature of this team approach, which I've been discussing, is worthy of mention here. Although we feel that the provisions of the administrative code are adequate to protect environmental health during the development of oil and other industries in Alaska, the Department of Health and Welfare and Federal Water Pollution Control Administration personnel are developing a set of guidelines which will amplify these administrative code provisions in a clearer, more readable fashion. One example related to North Slope activities deals with the ultimate disposal of garbage and other solid wastes generated in the drilling and construction activities. It is our judgment that the state cannot long permit the burial of organic refuse in permafrost areas in such a way as to assure preservation rather than biodegradation. Accordingly, in this example, I anticipate that our guidelines document will require appropriate sewage treatment, either by a conventional process or through some modification at the larger camps, and possibly incineration of toilet wastes where it is not practical to provide an adequate liquid waste disposal. Similarly, the guidelines document may be expected to require incineration or some disposal process other than burial for other waste solids generated from North Slope activities. In this presentation, I have attempted to touch on at least the highlights of a cooperative program in which federal experts from a number of agencies have provided extremely valuable technical assistance to the state agency charged with statutory authority for controlling environmental health in Alaska. I trust that this team approach will continue as Alaska works to build a self-sufficient economy where industry and conservation are compatible and fully complementary. Mr. Chairman, I have abridged my presentation somewhat. I ask that the complete statement be included in the record.
The statement will be designated as Exhibit Number 4, and thank you, Mr. Andry. Next witness is Commissioner Harold D. Strandberg, Department of Public Works, State of Alaska. Mr. Secretary, members of the panel, my name is Harold Strandberg. I'm Commissioner of Public Works for the State of Alaska. This department is responsible for practically all state construction, with the exception of projects under the jurisdiction of the Department of Highways. To assure the Department of Interior that the State of Alaska is fully able and qualified from past experience to protect the public interest in construction of the proposed pipeline from Prudhoe Bay to Valdez, I will outline for you briefly the construction and environmental control requirements that each division of the Department of Public Works place on its contractors. Four divisions of the Department of Public Works involved in construction include the Division of Aviation, the Division of Buildings, the Division of Water and Harbors, and the Division of Marine Transportation. The Division of Aviation. Environmental control items are inherent in all airport construction activities. All contract specifications require that upon completion of the work and before acceptance and final payment will be made, contractors are required to remove from the site all machinery, equipment, surplus and discarded material, rubbish, temporary structures, the stumps or portion of trees. They must also cut all brush and wood within the limits indicated and leave the site in a neat and presentable condition. Material cleared from the site and disposed of on property adjacent is not considered to be disposed of satisfactorily. Precautions are taken to make sure salmon spawning streams are not adversely affected by the construction activity, and this phase is coordinated closely with the Department of Fish and Game. In timbered areas, contractors are required to leave cleared areas clean, remove downed trees, berms, and other debris. The Forest Service is contacted during this phase to make certain compliance is in accordance with their standards. In disturbed areas where vegetation cover is damaged, contractors work closely with the Soil Conservation Service are required to reseed the areas affected. Water and sewer system plans are coordinated with the Department of Health and Welfare. Borrow areas are required to be left neat. Borrow pits and waste piles are located in areas not in public view wherever possible. Access and haul roads are located on the best possible alignment in order to serve other community needs, such as providing access to wood cutting areas, water supply sources, boat mooring areas, and cemeteries. In some cases, roads are designed and intended to also serve as fire breaks. Special attention is given to preserving anthropological and archaeological sites, such as the old village of Barrow and sites at Wrangell. Precautions are taken to ensure that rerouted drainage interrupted by either physical construction or temporary construction activities does not cause flood damage to adjacent land, cause erosion, pollute streams, or disturb fish spawning grounds. In clearing land necessary for airport development, inclusion of safe approaches is necessary, but airport engineers are cautioned not to overclear. In urban or suburban areas, or wherever appropriate, cut and fill slopes are carefully seeded, both for stability, land erosion control, and for appearance. We have an active program to have municipal sewers extended to serve our airports in order to provide these facilities with the best disposal system available. Maintenance and operation efforts correct erosion or other environmental problems as they become apparent during inspection. Airport maintenance efforts also assist in solving local environmental problems wherever possible. The Building Division. At building projects located in areas with a tundra-type cover, the environmental and climatic value of the tundra is a concern of the Department of Public Works. We require contractors not to disturb the tundra any more than possible and use every effort to retain the natural state. This often results in having buildings constructed on piling. We also require closely controlled working areas, confine the site for storage of material, and limit access to work areas around the project. Good site housekeeping practices are mandatory in order that existing tundra cover is kept to its natural form. We have a contract requirement the stipulation that the entire contract area be cleared of rubbish, rubble, and waste material upon completion of the work. For access areas to be used permanently, we require replacing the tundra with a gravel fill to provide insulating values and stability. All plans of the Division of Buildings are reviewed by the Fire Marshal and the Department of Health and Welfare for compliance with State of Alaska standards. During the construction of small installations, the Department of Public Works provides water and sewer facilities by drilling wells and installing septic tanks in conjunction with leach pits or drain fields. A 6-inch diameter cased well produces 3 gallons of water per minute, and a 500-gallon septic tank with an 8 by 8 by 8 deep leaching pit satisfactorily provides 4 or 5 personnel with adequate water and waste facilities, provided the well and the waste system are heated if permafrost or extreme temperatures are encountered. Size of the water and sewer system depends on the length of time the site is occupied. In larger occupancy areas, a sewage treatment plant may be required. In areas lacking a water supply because of frozen ground. A water tank is installed within the buildings for drinking, cooking, and wash water. This water is then wasted to a leach pit. Body wastes are disposed of in a gas-fired combustion toilet or chemical toilet. The chemical toilets requires waste to the leaching pit or to a natural or man-made lagoon or waste stability pond in the vicinity. Division of Water and Harbors. The Division of Water and Harbors is responsible for the construction of all harbor facilities constructed and operated by the state. We cooperate with both the U.S. Corps of Engineers and the Department of Interior in this program. Projects funded by the Department of Interior through its Bureau of Outdoor Recreation program must meet the various stipulations required by that program. A copy of these stipulations is included in the material provided you. The same general conditions as outlined by the Division of Aviation and Division of Buildings for construction contracts apply to the Division of Water and Harbors. The Division of Marine Transportation. While the Division of Marine Transportation is not involved in any of the environmental controls or proposed right-of-way stipulations for the pipeline right-of-way under discussion, I thought it might be beneficial to outline to you plans we have for at least partially solving the problem of pollution of our offshore waters by vessels of our marine highway system. With this in mind, I have included the division's plan for the immediate future. The vessels of the Alaska Marine Highway System each constitute a complete floating community, such as they encounter the same disposal and pollution problems experienced in every community. In the years gone by, it was no problem as on all ships, everything just went over the side. While this was a convenient and inexpensive method of disposal, it caused much irreparable harm to the waters upon which the vessels sailed, to say nothing of the appearance of the adjacent shoreline. Unfortunately, this practice continues with many of the ships plying Alaskan waters today. The state ferry system long ago recognized the potential for pollution and the resulting effect on the ecology and have taken steps to prevent pollution of the waters of Alaska upon which they sail. There are three satisfactory methods of disposal of a ship's waste. They are dumping ashore in sanitary landfills, special barges in the case of oils, solvents, and similar liquids, or upon the high seas in authorized dump areas. The state ferries use a combination of all three methods. Lubricating oils that are no longer used in the ship's mechanical equipment are purified to the greatest extent possible on board. The oil is then pumped into the ship's heavy fuel tanks where it is burned as fuel. This small addition of lubricating oil to the heavy crude oil used as fuel is consumed without producing smoke or polluting the atmosphere. Disposal of refuse from the galley, dining room, and other passenger areas is one of the most difficult problems. By sheer volume, the accumulations of 2 or 3 days during the height of the tourist season is overwhelming, to say nothing about the lack of storage space or the possible odor which could be generated from such accumulations. Finding a satisfactory method of disposal has been most difficult. For some time, we have been using weighted plastic bags, disposing the refuse overboard in the more remote areas of our voyage. We have not been satisfied with this method, although the fish may have been. We have now hit upon a solution which we believe will be the first in maritime industry, or at least the first in Alaskan waters. During the ship's annual overhaul this winter, hydraulically compacting machines will be installed. These machines are electric hydraulic operated and compact refuse on a 4-to-1 ratio. After compaction, the refuse is inserted directly into sealed carts. The carts will be hauled ashore at various wayports and their contents disposed of by commercial sanitary fill operators. I am confident this procedure will soon become the standard by which all water carriers operating in Alaska will be judged. to future ensure the purity of our water, those persons responsible for planning and design of our new ships have been instructed to incorporate waste holding tanks in the ship's design. All waste will be pumped ashore for disposal. This is the ultimate in safety against pollution, and the Alaska Ferry System will again be the leaders in the field in Alaska. Remote as it may seem, the disposal of waste along Alaska's highways also become a concern of the ferry system. Many travelers in campers and trailers utilize their weight at the terminals for house cleaning. The results are quite startling. At Haines Terminal, there are 11 to 12 55-gallon drums for the convenience of the traveler, and these drums require emptying daily during the summer. On varying scales, this is repeated at every terminal of the ferry system. The Division of Marine Transportation is especially concerned about the pollution of Alaska's air and water. Scenic and uncluttered and unspoiled environment are the greatest attraction for tourists visiting our state, and one of the main reasons why we have chosen Alaska as our home. It is difficult to sell a scenic cruise in a smog-filled sewer. Conclusion. I know that this brief outline of the efforts of the Department of Public Works to perfect the environment of Alaska will help to assure you that state control of the tremendous construction job entailed by the pipeline from Valdez to Prudhoe Bay will be completed in a manner which will protect not only the interests of Alaska, but the balance of the United States as well.
Thank you, Commissioner Strandberg. We will mark your written statement and the stipulations attached as exhibit number 5. The next witness is H.D. Skugel, Deputy Commissioner, Department of Highways, State of Alaska.
Hesden D. Skugel, Deputy Commissioner of Highways for the State of Alaska. I have been an Alaskan all of my adult life, 8 years of which have been involved with Arctic construction, logistics, and exploration. I have been associated with the construction industry for 32 years. The area of subjects we are discussing today concerns a pioneering effort in the state of Alaska which has no equal within the history of man's taming of his earth. The challenges and opportunities we face today are without precedent. Fortunately, however, we are approaching these challenges with more knowledge than any other pioneers of our continent have had. We Alaskans have some very valuable assets which will help us to do the job and to assure the quality of our work in all of its requirements. We have a corps of Alaskans which include 88 registered professional engineers, former university professors, and highly trained men in other fields, and approximately 1,200 administrators, scientists, equipment operators and mechanics throughout the state who have an abiding affection for the land, who have had long experience working in the Arctic, and who are Alaskans, many native born. Our Department of Highways has, for several years, sponsored the Arctic Engineering Course in cooperation with the University of Alaska. The speaker was associated with the firm which in 1946 managed the first Arctic laboratory at Point Barrow under the John Hopkins University and now administered by the University of Alaska. The Arctic and its unique problems and challenges are not foreign to us. Among our people are men who have worked on the construction of the Alaska Highway, the Alaska Railroad, the Dew Line, the White Isles projects, and other military and state installations above the Arctic Circle. Last winter, they built the Walter J. Hickel Highway, and that much maligned first thrust to the Arctic proved that man can work effectively in a field in the Arctic without destroying it. Our people were involved in the International Geophysical Year of 1956, during which the submarine Squalus made the first trip underneath the Arctic ice to Europe. These are men who know the Arctic and have found out the hard way what man can and cannot do there. Words which sound strange to many people are common parts of their vocabulary. Words such as permafrost, whiteout, tundra, ice fog, and 75 degrees below zero. They have seen the destruction which man can create, and they have learned also that he can work between here and the North Pole without destroying the peculiar wild beauty of that sometimes bitterly hostile land. These men are uniquely qualified to work in the Arctic and are cautious of the land. I have seen them work through the long, terrible Arctic night into the bright dawning days of the Arctic spring. They, like nearly all Alaskans, are concerned with conservation, and they know what it is. They believe in the conservation of the land, of the wild animals, and the unique forms of life which exist there. To them, conservation is for the sake of the future greatness of our great land, and the future generations of Alaskans who will live here. Our experience, effectiveness, and care are a matter of record. Consider the fact that during the many years which Alaska spent as a stepchild of the lower 48 states, relatively few miles of road were built in the territory. A high percentage of the roads in our system today have been built, realigned, or rebuilt in the decades since statehood. We are neither unqualified nor inexperienced in matters of road building above and below the Arctic Circle. In accomplishing these things, we have not worked alone. We presently enjoy a very effectively working relationship with an equally well-qualified staff at the Bureau of Public Roads and its predecessor, which has been involved in the construction of roads and highways in Alaska since 1905. And was a builder of the Alaska Highway completed during the war years, as well as the Steeves, Taylor, Elliott, and Richardson Highways. Our geologists and engineers have worked in cooperation with the U.S. Geological Survey and the Coast and Geodetic Survey. Since the disastrous earthquake of 1964, our department, in cooperation with the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service and the Alaska Department of Fish and Game, has rehabilitated crossings of a number of the spawning streams which were affected by the earthquake. The Department of Highways is concerned with the grading and drainage and the preventing of erosions in these situations. Our highways are not built by one department alone, but by a team of state and federal departments and agencies, including the University of Alaska, the State Department of Fish and Game, the State Department of Public Works, the U.S. Bureau of Public Roads, the Federal Aviation Administration, and the Department of Commerce, and your own Department of Interior, in addition to others. I would like to suggest to you gentlemen a field inspection of one of our highways recently completed in the heart of a locally conservation-sensitive area. Your in-depth inspection of the Blaine Road will demonstrate to you that we do know how to protect the environment and preserve it in the best interests of all concerned. I might add that the construction I'm talking about was done under extreme adverse conditions. Circumstances notwithstanding, we completed the construction and made it a thing of beauty. I don't think there will be any doubts in your minds that we do have the expertise and the concern to preserve the environment, to preserve the habitat of the wildlife while developing Alaska's surface transportation. If you travel our highways, you will notice that we have built roads to federally accepted standards of construction, and that we have kept the dictates of conservation before us at all times. Minimum necessary space taken for roads and shoulders, fill and cutaway areas have been graded and seeded to eliminate erosion. Drainage problems are dealt with in unique and sometimes very costly ways, all with an eye to protect the environment. We are not interested merely in building roads, but in building roads which will enhance the environment and the condition of life in every respect. As further graphic evidence of the standards to and by which our work is done for Alaska, we submit a copy of the construction manual of the state of Alaska, which explains in great depth the construction procedures and requirements for grading and drainage, for hand clearing, for clearing work done by hand, for the burning of brush, the policies established for roadside beautification, for waste disposal, roadside cleanup, rest areas, selected clearing and grubbing. It includes the planting of trees and shrubs and vines and grass to prevent the erosion of the soil and erosion in the streams where Mother Nature quite hasn't done an adequate job. The evidence before you today, gentlemen, should adequately demonstrate that the state of Alaska is ready, willing, qualified, and capable of managing the use and preservation of the land in our great state. Thank you.
Commissioner, do you have a written statement that you also want to present? We'll mark the written statement as exhibit number 6, and we'll mark the construction manual as exhibit number 7.
Okay.
And we thank you. I believe the undersecretary would like to make a few comments.
Does that conclude the testimony of the state witnesses? Thank you. I made two or three notes during the course of the state presentation, which, if I may, I would like to run through for the record. First, I think that the state representatives have made a very fine presentation of the work that the state agencies has done and is doing in the field of resource management. And certainly we in the Department of Interior have absolutely no argument whatsoever with the competence of the state agencies responsible for resource and environmental management. None whatsoever. Indeed, in every case where the state does have exclusive legal jurisdiction, we certainly agree that it is the state that should have full authority over environmental management. For example, where it was possible to lift the land freeze for that 53-mile road stretch from Live and Good to the Yukon, the federal government did so expeditiously, as I pointed out, and in doing so attached no stipulations whatsoever to the grant of authority to the state, simply accepting the assurance of the governor that adequate environmental safeguards would be imposed. However, I think it's also important to point out that under present circumstances, the great bulk of the land involved in the 800-mile pipeline application is not state controlled land at the present time. For the state to acquire jurisdiction over that land, it would have to select it. And as we know, the selection is, or such selection is barred while the present freeze, land freeze, is in effect. except where special permission can be acquired from the appropriate committees of Congress. I might also point out that there are some important areas along the right-of-way that are already withdrawn for various uses, either by the federal government for national forests, for the Rampart Dam site, and for other purposes that could not be selected. Finally, as a general comment, whether the job is done by the state or by the federal government cannot alter in any way at all the nature of the problems that must be solved. And if the problem, for example, of thermal destruction of the permafrost by the proposed pipeline has not yet been solved, it will not be solved simply by moving the problem from one government entity to another one. The real delays, if these can be characterized as delays, the real delays in acting on the pipeline application are due to the fact that we do not yet have answers to all such critical problems. And again, I would say that the answers cannot be found simply by moving authority over them from one government to another. On this matter of permafrost, I had hoped to make a comment in my opening statement, and Dr. Pecora was bringing me some notes. And as you recall, he was a little late in arriving. He had an environmental problem of his own. He had a flat tire on the way over here. So if I may mention this at this time, a little out of the order I'd intended, and I would ask him to expand on it if it seems indicated. The survey, as you know, has had more than 20 years of field experience in analyzing engineering geology characteristics of permafrost terrain. This experience has led the survey to conclude that degradation of the thermal regime of permafrost in Alaska, such as would be induced by a buried hot pipeline, will have real and major consequences for construction and maintenance. Some of these factors include subsidence and compaction, mass erosion on slopes, effects on bearing strength of materials, frost heave effects, buoyant potential, access road maintenance, all of which will endanger the success of the primary mission and will destroy the integrity of the structure. A computation was made by the survey and completed within the last 2 or 3 days, and I only saw it yesterday on this matter, and if it has not already been made available to TAPS, I'm sure it will be today, this morning. And as I say, I only saw it yesterday on the way here with Dr. Pecora, and he had just gotten it. The survey's thermal degradation analysis calculates that over a span of 1 to 20 years, the depth of melting from the pipeline will range from 24 feet in 1 year to 40 or 50 feet in 20 years. Lateral melting is equally substantial. Dr. Pecora, do you want to expand on that in any way?
Very briefly, Mr. Secretary. The analysis was based on the input factors provided by the engineering characteristics of the pipeline structure and referred to computer analysis in order to develop the procedural relationship in analyzing results. I'd be very happy to discuss this in some detail with members of TAPS. You may recall that our meeting with the North Commission some time ago in Anchorage, the question was asked of the TAPS representatives, had such a computer analysis been made of the thermal degradation, and we were advised at that time that it was in process. We have made an independent one, and we would like very much to check with your staff to determine whether or not there are other inputs or whether the analysis would be an acceptable one. We rather feel that our analysis is conservative, but nevertheless, we would like to match it with your analysis and at least discuss it in some detail. The second point or question raised at the North Commission meetings was the experience from the Russian construction of pipelines in their permafrost terrain. We have made since then many translations from the Russian, and I should like to make this available to the TAP staff if you do not have such references available to you. We are concerned because their major conclusion is not to put any hot pipeline below the surface, below the tundra, to interrupt the thermal regime of the permafrost. Therefore, we need to have our technical people and our scientists and engineers talk together, work these things out to determine what the problems are, because our major concern here is to engineer against the difficulties to make the mission a successful one. Thank you, Mr. Secretary.
Thank you, Bill.
The hearing will be in recess for 15 minutes.
We have one more comment from Dr. Glasgow.
I'm, of course, proud to have come from the greatest oil-producing state in this country, Louisiana. And there I had an opportunity to gain a good bit of experience working with pipeline companies in the marsh, which is also a fragile environment. And we had real problems there, and in general, the oil industry did an excellent job in handling those problems. And I'm sure the same thing will be true here. But like all industries or all populations of people, there must be some enforcement of the regulations which are laid down. And I was wondering if we might get a little bit of elaboration on just how the enforcement or compliance might be secured if the state were to assume the responsibilities.
Governor, I think perhaps we might take a break and then give the state 5 minutes to address itself to that.
That would be most helpful.
Would that be helpful? I think it would be certainly only fair. Dr. Pecora had one other comment he wanted to make.
I merely wanted to add, Mr. Secretary, for the record, that we have had conversations with our counterparts in the University of Alaska. We have mentioned the study that we have been making with our counterparts in the state of Alaska, and my remarks as addressed to TAPS as an organization was not intended to exclude them from our discussions, but merely to emphasize the point that here is a common problem that we all need to put our best brains and thinking upon it so that we can lick it. Thank you very much.
All right, we'll take a recess then for 15 minutes, and I understand that coffee is available in the foyer. Governor Miller, who do you wish to present?
With your permission, I would like to call upon the Attorney General for the State of Alaska, Mr. G. Kent Edwards, to answer Dr. Glasgow's question.
Mr. Secretary, distinguished members of the panel, in response to your question, Dr. Glasgow, I think it be best to approach it in this manner. I believe that the testimony of the state thus far has indicated the large body of law that the state has, not only statutorily but by regulations, to work with and to apply in the type of operation that we'd be concerned with in the pipeline construction, development, and operation. And we have also outlined, in addition to those particular, that particular body of law, the nature of various administrative operations through permits that are granted to various individuals, permittees, in operating in this type of an area. And I think that one of the examples given, or the phrase referred to quite often, is the team approach. The fact that there is a lot of overlap in the various interests of the various departments in this type, in a project of this magnitude, and that it would seem to me that, as in any case, if there is a violation or a failure to regard a particular type of requirement, whether it be through stipulation or a statute or regulation, that the particular agency who has initiated or who is charged with the responsibility in that area, whether it be fish and game for streams, whether it be natural resources for the various land permits or highways for a particular service road, would be the initial agency to bring the violation to the attention of the particular contractor. And in doing this, it's clear that in this type of an area, when you're dealing with the remoteness, that it will be necessary to have the various inspection teams present. And it's going to be quite likely, I would assume, that you would find at various times a member from the Department of Natural Resources, a member from the Department of Fish and Game, a member from Highways, or whichever department in particular is concerned at the time, present to attempt to see that compliance is being made and to call violations to the attention. And if they're not complied with, well then, as a matter of last resort, obviously it would be referred to our department for legal action and court support as to the rights that have been violated, and make sure that enforcement takes place. I hope that this is the area that of your concern. I believe that it was probably along the tenor of who's really going to be present to see that these things are being complied with, if I'm correct. Is that?
Yeah, this was the area that I was concerned about, and it's my understanding that there will be several segments of the line under construction simultaneously, that there will be several contractors, there will be sub-subcontractors, and so forth on down the line. Now, this would take considerable manpower and finances and a lot of effort to supervise, and I was wondering, it can't just seems to me be one or two, but it would have to be a good many people involved here. And I was wondering what your capability would be under these circumstances.
Well, naturally, it'd be difficult for me to be specific since, again, unless we have a specific situation as to, you know, factually, it would be hard to describe. I would assume that whatever the needs will be as far as personnel and seeing that the various projects are being complied with, that those needs will be met, and will be met with by the state with having the needed personnel there. I think at present we obviously have more personnel in the state of Alaska dealing in this area than, say, the federal government does. The financial capabilities, I would assume, of the federal government of being able to raise some of these finances to apply additional ones may be greater than the state, but I do think that the state's capabilities will be adequate to provide these people and to make sure that everything is enforced. And I do realize it is a problem that will have to be addressed, and I know we appreciate your directing the attention to this area. That personnel will be an important factor to consider.
Thank you, Mr. Edwards.
Thank you.
We have estimated in the federal government very roughly, I think, about 130 full-time personnel would be required in working with the pipeline construction alone. And this would indicate to us the need for a considerable addition to our existing personnel, and of course considerable additional monies. I mentioned these just for what guidance they might give.
I see. I'm not personally familiar with any particular estimates of the state as far as, you know, the actual needed personnel.
Thank you, Mr. Edwards.
Thank you.
The next witness is R.G. Delaney, Chairman, Trans-Alaska Pipeline System.
Mr. Chairman, members of the panel, my name is R.G. Delaney. I serve as chairman of the management committee for the owners of Trans-Alaska Pipeline System, a joint project of Atlantic Pipeline Company, BP Pipeline Corporation, and the Humboldt Pipeline Company. With your permission, Mr. Chairman, I would like to introduce some of my colleagues at this time. Mr. P.H. Hunter of Humboldt Pipeline Company, Mr. E.W. Wellbaum of BP Pipeline Corporation, who are my colleagues on the management committee, and Mr. George Hughes, project manager, and David Henderson, resident manager in Alaska. We appreciate the opportunity to appear here today to make this statement on behalf of the Trans-Alaska Pipeline System. To conform to the time limitations, we have prepared a number of exhibits which we wish to have included in the record of this proceeding. I shall identify the nature of these exhibits as we move along. The choice is not between a pipeline or the preservation of the Alaska ecology. From the outset, our policy has been to design the structure and to provide an operational control system which will cause the least disturbance to the environment. In the Alaska environment, good ecology practices and good engineering practices are synonymous. The possibility of a petroleum pipeline from the North Slope to tidewaters on Alaska's south coast was first evaluated in a preliminary fashion as early as 1963. This was prior to the initiation of the exploratory drilling program that resulted in the Prudhoe discovery. After the discovery and confirmation, more comprehensive studies were initiated by the Atlantic and Humboldt pipeline companies. A pipeline system for supplying the North Slope crude to the West Coast was again examined, as well as alternate means of transport to other markets, U.S. and worldwide. One of these alternates was a tanker route through the Northwest Passage. As you may know, the tanker SS Manhattan is now underway to test this route. I mentioned